Welcome to Hub History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 58, Harvard's Human Computers Reach for the Stars. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss a group of women who made historic advances in the field of astronomy. During an era more associated with the Wild West, these women discovered new stars and fundamental principles about how our universe works. In the early years, they were treated as menial workers and paid a fraction of what their male counterparts got. Only decades later did they win academic respect, earning advanced degrees, and finally the title professor. They were the human computers of the Harvard University Observatory. But before we talk about Harvard's human computers, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
The Gibson House Museum is located on Beacon Street in the Back Bay, just a block from the Public Garden and the tourist magnet that is the Cheers Bar. Despite its premium location, it's very easy to miss as you walk down Beacon. It's a stone and brick townhouse, and it appears to be completely ordinary for a fine Back Bay brownstone. A small red sign with gold letters identifies it as a museum, but otherwise it seems unremarkable. When you step through the heavy walnut double doors, you walk backwards in time. Absolutely nothing in the house has been touched since 1954, and very little has changed at all since the house was originally built in 1860. The tidal Back Bay was dammed to provide water power to mills in 1821. After decades of little success, the city, state, and the Boston Water Power Company eventually entered into an agreement to fill in the stagnant mill pond and create a lavish new neighborhood. Contractors began bringing in sand and gravel from the suburban Charles and Neponset River valleys in 1857. The project would continue until the turn of the 20th century. The house at 137 Beacon was only the second home to be built after development began on the first filled blocks. A wealthy widow named Catherine Hammond Gibson took a risk and became one of the early pioneers in what would become a very common migration for Boston's Brahmin class. Gibson lived at the top of Beacon Hill with her family, bought a Back Bay building lot for $3,696 at auction, and was one of the first to make the move. That pattern of wealthy Brahmin families moving from Beacon Hill to the Back Bay became so typical that it even forms part of the backstory for the 1990s TV series Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman.
Didn't you love Father?
Of course I loved your father. But I had to choose from a small selection of men at a very specific time in my life. And it was Beacon Hill to Back Bay, not Boston, to Colorado.
Catherine Gibson built the grand home on Beacon Street in hopes that it would help her son Charles Hammond Gibson find a suitable wife. Eventually, he was successful. In 1871, Charles married Rosamond Warren, who was a descendant of Harvard Medical School founder John Warren. This Tuesday, December 12th, is actually their anniversary. Soon, they had three children, Mary Ethel, Little Rosamond, and Charles Jr. As they grew up, both daughters married and moved into their own grand homes in the Back Bay.
Charles Jr. went to school in New Hampshire, then the MIT School of Architecture for a few months before withdrawing. He spent several years traveling around Europe, writing books and poetry. Under the pseudonym Richard Sudbury, he published a text on the Royal Chateau of rural France called Two Gentlemen of Touraine. It would become the standard text on the topic for years to come. The rest of his books are more frivolous, and some readers have made inference from his poetry. For example, The Wounded Eros is a series of sonnets describing love lost and loved found, but never mentions a woman. When asked what that might say about his sexual orientation, museum curator Wendy Swanton says, "He was a very eccentric, lifelong bachelor, a poet, and an author. We have no proof or documentation that he was gay or not. In a way, I feel we should respect his privacy and let others draw their own conclusions as they wish." Without prying too much into his personal life, the lifelong bachelor, Charles Jr., moved back into the house at 137 Beacon with Rosamond after Charles Sr.'s death in 1916. He began cultivating a persona as the ultimate Boston Brahmin, a throwback to an earlier era. A later profile in the Boston Herald described him as a proper Bostonian whose Victorian elegance puts modern manners to shame, and a small man with a nimble, if sometimes cantankerous, physique. He strolls around with a sort of swagger stick with a silver tip, out of deference to the fact that gold would be too vulgar. He affected an English accent and was always quick to mention his ties to the elites of Boston, London, and Paris. In 1934, Rosamond also passed away. By this time, museum guide Katie Schinnebeck says Charles Jr. was dedicated to keeping everything exactly as she had left it, and to preserving, in his manner and dress, the lifestyle of his parents. In a way, he was the world's first hipster, self-consciously adopting the style and mannerisms of a bygone era. As the Great Depression raged, many of his neighbors moved out to the growing Boston suburbs, and the Back Bay entered a period of decline. The grand homes were broken up as rooming houses or apartments, sold to local institutions, or simply boarded up and abandoned. In 1950, the Herald would say that Charles Jr. deplores the foibles of the age, an age in which he sees the heights of aristocracy being leveled into plains where all men are considered alike. While he often gets cross about all this, he can laugh at it too.
By the mid-1930s, Charles Gibson Jr. had already made up his mind that the house would become a museum upon his death. An article in Harvard Magazine said, "Within a few years, he was living in only a portion of the house. The other rooms were already roped off awaiting display. Visitors were treated to martinis and stale bread in the stairway, because he didn't want people sitting on the furniture. He also wrote notes and tagged furniture, artwork, and personal items for future stewards, obviously concerned that the world was leaving him behind." Charles Jr. maintained his eccentric ways right up until the end. Into the 1950s, he kept up a habit of walking to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel every night, where he would take his dinner in a full tuxedo and tails, top hat, and a raccoon coat in cold weather. His neighbors would call him Mr. Boston. Before he died in 1954, he wrote his own obituary, in which he described himself as a poet and horticulturist who delighted in being designated as a proper Bostonian. And he described his home as a period museum of the years from the Victorian era until today. He had also set up Gibson Society, which was established to maintain the house in perpetuity. It opened as a museum in 1957. We visited in February of 2016, and the house seems ready for Rosamond to walk through the door at any moment. Everything from the books and papers on the desks to the signed notes from Winston Churchill and Queen Elizabeth II to the place settings is undisturbed from the last time Charles Jr. left it. When we were there, we got a special upstairs-downstairs tour that focused on the lives and work of the household servants that supported the Gibson House and every fashionable home in Victorian Boston. Keep that in mind when we come to this week's main story, as one of the central characters was a maid and housekeeper in a similar home in the same time period. If you're interested in visiting, we'll have a link to more information in the show notes this week.
And for our upcoming event this week, we want to share a talk at the Needham Historical Society. Jeff Bellinger bills himself as a paranormal researcher and founder of a website about what he calls the legend-tripping movement. He's made a number of TV appearances to talk about supposed paranormal activity, and he's written a dozen books. If you've been in the gift shop of a Boston-area tourist attraction in the past few years, you've almost certainly encountered his 2008 book called Weird Massachusetts. It catalogs all the legendary beasts, haunted cemeteries, and offbeat museums in the Bay State. On Thursday, December 14th, Bellinger will turn his unique point of view to the Christmas season. In a talk at the Needham History Center and Museum, he'll discuss the darker traditional stories from around the world. Here's a description from the museum's website. "There are many Yuletide monsters and legends that have almost been lost to the ages. Explore the history of these ghostly holiday traditions, some dating back more than 2,000 years. Krampus, the Belsnickel, Tomptons, and who can forget the most famous ghost story of all time, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol." Plus, it includes the warning, this program may not be suitable for young children. Holiday stories that require a parental advisory label definitely get the Hub History seal of approval. The talk starts at 7 p.m. and it's free and open to the public. For a link to the museum's calendar of events, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/058.
When we think of computers today, we think of the amazing devices that let us do everything from access books and faraway archives, to decode the human genome, to record podcasts. As a matter of fact, this microphone's plugged into one right now. But before electronics, the word computer referred to a person who computed, or did calculations. Human computers may sound like something out of science fiction, like the Mentats from the 1984 movie Dune.
19 light years beyond many lilacs.
The training planet of the Mentats, the human computers. Noah Mentat by his red-stained lips.
It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It is by the juice of Safu that thoughts acquire speed. The lips acquire stains. The stains become a warning. It is by will alone I set my mind in motion.
Real human computers were vital to science and technology right up to the dawn of the space age, with some of the earliest working on problems of astronomy. In 1750, a team of French computers correctly calculated that Halley's Comet would return in 1759. British computers calculated navigation tables to include nautical almanacs so sailors could work out where they were anywhere in the world. Later computers would work on the Manhattan Project and the Apollo missions. If the idea of women working as human computers is fresh in your mind, it might be because of the movie Hidden Figures, which came out in January. The film celebrates the lives and careers of a group of African-American women who worked as computers for NASA during the early space race. The central character is Katherine Johnson, a brilliant mathematician who grew up in segregated West Virginia. She worked on every major project from the first American in space, to the moon landings, to the space shuttle. When John Glenn was chosen to orbit the Earth for the first time, he refused to do it unless Katherine Johnson verified the calculations an early electronic computer had made. Today, Johnson is 99 years old, and she's been retired since 1986. Our story, however, begins over a century before that. Legend has it that the director of the Harvard Observatory in Cambridge went on a tear in 1881. The young men who worked as computers in the observatory were doing what he considered shoddy work. And while dressing them down, he shouted, "My Scotch maid could do a better job." Luckily for Edward Charles Pickering, his Scottish-American maid proved that she was more than up to the task.
Wilhelmina Stevens grew up in Dundee, Scotland. Mina was an outstanding student and began teaching school when she was just 14 years old. She married an older, widowed carver and gilder named James Fleming in 1877 when she was 21. Together, they immigrated to America, arriving in New York on December 3, 1878, before seeking their fortunes in Boston. About a year later, while Mina was pregnant with their firstborn child, James left the family. Wilhelmina Fleming found herself alone in a foreign land with no money, no husband, and a new child. Teaching school, the only profession she had any experience with, was not available to her. Only men and young, unmarried women could teach, so Fleming was forced to seek work as a maid. If you tour the Gibson House Museum, imagine young Mina as your guide describes daily duties the household servants were expected to perform. Through sheer luck, Wilhelmina Fleming began working as a housekeeper for the Pickering family in 1879. Perhaps out of gratitude, she named her young son Edward Pickering Fleming. Though it may sound like a long way from there to the Harvard Observatory, some accounts say that Pickering's wife quickly realized Mina's intelligence and recommended that he find work for her at the observatory. By 1880, she was doing some clerical tasks for the observatory alongside her duties as a maid. But in 1881, she was invited to join a team that would soon revolutionize the field of spectrographic astronomy.
Spectrographic astronomy used advanced photographic techniques to allow researchers at Harvard to classify and analyze distant stars. This was happening in 1881. That July, gunfighter Billy the Kid was shot and killed by Sheriff Pat Garrett in New Mexico Territory. Just a week later, 186 members of the Hunkpapa Lakota Band, led by Sitting Bull, went to a small fort in northern Dakota Territory and surrendered to the U.S. Army. In September, the Apache Band led by Geronimo broke out of their reservation in Arizona Territory and continued their war against both the Mexican and U.S. armies. In December 1881, Town Marshal Virgil Earp and his brothers Morgan and Wyatt Earp, and their friend Doc Holliday, attempted to enforce the town gun control laws in Tombstone, Arizona. Town Ordinance No. 9 required anyone entering town with a gun or knife to check their weapons until they left town again. After some freedom-loving cowboys flaunted this rule by continuing to openly carry their guns in town, the officers confronted them in a vacant lot on 3rd Street near the OK Corral.
Go ahead, skin it. Skin that smoke wagon and see what happens.
In the gunfight that followed, 30 shots were fired in about 30 seconds. 3 cowboys were killed, while Doc Holliday and 2 of the Earp brothers were wounded. The gunfight at the OK Corral is one of the most iconic stories of the American West, and it happened the same year that Wilhelmina Fleming joined the observatory staff at Harvard. For most people, the history of America in the late 19th century is synonymous with the frontier, a lawless, violent place ruled by gunfighters and cowboys and Indian chiefs. That mythological vision of the West has come to define how Americans see ourselves as a nation and how we're seen around the world.
But in 1881, the vast majority of Americans lived lives that were more similar to that of Wilhelmina Fleming than Wyatt Earp. At the time of the 1880 census, the vast majority of Americans lived east of the Mississippi, and most lived north of the Mason-Dixon line. The country was beginning a process of urbanization that would accelerate and continue well into the 20th century. Already, 28% of the U.S. population lived in cities, and that number was much higher in the Northeast, where most of the population lived. Massachusetts was the second most heavily urban state at 62%, behind only Little Rhode Island. Boston was the 5th most populous city in the nation. The population of Boston and Cambridge was larger than that of Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Arizona, Nevada, Washington, and Montana combined. In 1881, the Northeast was well connected by telegraph lines and a growing rail network. Steamers carried mail and news from Europe in record time. Boston was crisscrossed by streetcar lines, and by the end of the decade, they would convert from horse-drawn cars to electric power. The telephones invented by Bostonian Alexander Graham Bell were becoming increasingly popular, and electric light bulbs were just starting to catch on. The iconic image of America in the 19th century may be the Wild West, but the East sure was civilized.
In this civilized and technologically advanced Eastern world, Wilhelmina Fleming's journal casually mentions discovering a few brand new stars and nebulae after lunch one day. Before lunch, I found time to examine a few southern spectrum plates and marked a fourth type star and a gaseous nebula, both probably known. Later in the afternoon, I noted a few more interesting objects, among them 2 fourth type stars, 1 gaseous nebula, and several bright line stars. Some of them may be new. Using a new dry glass plate photography method, the Harvard Observatory was able to capture photographs of the night sky that were as clear as directly observing the sky through a telescope. However, instead of taking pictures of the sky as the eye would see it, they used a special prism to capture photographs of the spectrum of light emitted by each star, which would in turn reveal its chemical composition. In a book about the women of the observatory, Dava Sobel described how Fleming and the other women would handle these photos. She removed each glass plate from its craft paper sleeve without getting a single fingerprint on either of the 8x10-inch surfaces. The trick was to hold the fragile packet by its side edges between her palms, set the bottom, open end of the envelope on the specially designed stand, and then ease the paper up and off without letting go of the plate, as though undressing a baby. Making sure the emulsion side faced her, she released her grip and let the glass settle into place. The wooden stand held the plate in a picture frame tilted at a 45-degree angle. A mirror affixed to the flat base caught daylight from the computing room's big windows and directed illumination up through the glass. Wilhelmina Fleming and the other women at the observatory would hunch over the glass plates with magnifying glasses to see the tiny spectral streaks. Quickly computing the amount of hydrogen the spectrum revealed, they would classify the stars based on a system Fleming had developed and record the position of the star in the sky. Despite discovering the existence of white dwarf stars, cataloging tens of thousands of new stars and dozens of nebulae, including the Horsehead Nebula, Wilhelmina herself treated her daily work as being utterly routine. From day to day, my duties at the observatory are so nearly alike that there will be but little to describe outside ordinary routine work of measurement, examination of photographs, and work involved in the reduction of these observations. In the astrophotographic building of the observatory, 12 women, including myself, are engaged in the care of the photographs, identification, examination, and measurement of them, reduction of these measurements, and preparation of the results for the printer. The measurements made with the meridian photometers are also reduced and prepared for publication in this department of the observatory.
What Wilhelmina and the women of Harvard treated as a routine day in the office would have been astounding to most men of their era. At the time, conventional wisdom held that women were physically and emotionally unsuited to higher education or work in intellectual fields. Just a few years before, Harvard professor Edward Clark wrote about the dangers of educating girls in his 1873 book, Sex in Education. Quoting Dr. Fisher, he said, "A certain proportion of girls are apt to be quick, brilliant, ambitious, and persistent at study, and need not stimulation, but repression. For the sake of a temporary reputation for scholarship, they risk their health at the most susceptible period of their lives and break down after the excitement of a school life has passed away." The fact which Dr. Fisher alludes to, that many girls break down not during, but after the excitement of school or college life, is an important one and is apt to be overlooked. The process by which the development of the reproductive system is arrested, or degeneration of the brain and nerve tissue set a-going, is an insidious one. At its beginning, and for a long time after it is well on its progress, it would not be recognized by the superficial observer. A class of girls might, and often do, graduate from our schools, higher seminaries, and colleges that appear to be well and strong at the time of their graduation, but whose development has already been checked and whose health is on the verge of giving away. What Dr. Fisher fails to consider is that these women might simply be bored. Nevertheless, the women of the Harvard Observatory persisted in their work and somehow managed to avoid complete physical or mental breakdown. In fact, the university went out of its way to hire women for work in the observatory. As word of their success spread, other observatories around the country began to hire women as well. However, this preference for women had nothing to do with their innate intellectual abilities and everything to do with the fact that they could be paid about half the salary of a male employee. The director of the Yale Observatory was very frank about this, saying, "I am thoroughly in favor of employing women as measurers and computers. Not only are women available at smaller salaries than are men, but for the routine work they have important advantages. Men are more likely to grow impatient after the novelty of the work has worn off and would be harder to retain for that reason."
Despite her lifelong enthusiasm for the work, Wilhelmina Fleming always harbored a secret resentment of the pay gap for women. Right up through my own mother's generation, that pay gap was justified by saying that a man should be paid more for the same work because he would have a family to support. As a single woman, that logic didn't apply to Mina Fleming. She had a family to support, a child attending MIT, a home to pay for, and she still made less than the girls who worked in the textile mills in Lowell, much less her male colleagues in astronomy. Her private diaries are full of comments and complaints about the pay gap, like this one from March 12, 1900. "I had some conversation with the director regarding women's salaries. He seems to think that no work is too much or too hard for me, no matter what the responsibility or how long the hours. But let me raise the question of salary, and I am immediately told that I receive an excellent salary, as women's salaries stand. If he would only take some step to find out how much he is mistaken in regard to this, he would learn a few facts that would open his eyes and set him thinking. Sometimes I feel tempted to give up and let him try someone else, or some of the men to do my work, in order to have him find out what he is getting for $1,500 a year from me, compared with $2,500 from some of the other assistants. Does he ever think that I have a home to keep and a family to take care of as well as the men? but I suppose a woman has no claim to such comforts. And this is considered an enlightened age. I cannot make my salary meet my present expenses with Edward in the Institute and still another year there ahead of him. The director expects me to work from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., although my time called for is 7 hours a day, and I feel almost on the verge of breaking down. There is a great pressure of work, certainly, but why throw so much of it on me and pay me in such small proportion to the others, who come and go and take things easy?
Given that there's a 20% pay gap in my field, I can certainly sympathize. The disadvantages that women faced in the field of astronomy didn't stop more women from flocking to the Harvard Observatory. 11 years after Wilhelmina Fleming began working as a computer, a woman 11 years her junior joined the team. In many ways, Henrietta Swan Leavitt represented a new generation of women among the Harvard computers. Rather than stumbling into astronomy after applying for a job in menial clerical work, Leavitt came to the observatory in hopes of earning credit toward a graduate degree from Harvard. Leavitt grew up in Lancaster, Massachusetts, before attending Oberlin College and eventually getting her bachelor's degree from Radcliffe College in 1892, where she was able to take a single astronomy course. With a college degree and an interest in astronomy, Henrietta Swan Leavitt was a perfect candidate for what was becoming known as Pickering's harem of astronomical computers. Better still, at least in the eyes of Edward Charles Pickering, was the fact that she came from a wealthy family and didn't need to be paid for her work. Pickering assigned Henrietta Swan Leavitt to study variable stars, which sometimes appear brighter and sometimes appear dimmer. To compare their intensity, she would often overlay one glass plate atop another to see how the brightness changed over time. Within a few years, she made a discovery that would change how we understand our universe forever. She published her findings in a 1908 edition of the Annals of Astronomical Observatory of Harvard College, and they were published under her own name. Though, in a 1912 journal article that confirmed her findings and promoted them to the wider scientific world, Pickering put his own name on top and said merely that the supporting data had been prepared by Miss Leavitt.
We're not really smart enough with scientific terminology to figure out what Leavitt was saying in her 1908 paper, so luckily Pickering dumbed it down a bit in the 1912 version that he put his name on, saying, "A remarkable relation between the brightness of these variables and the length of their periods will be noticed. In HA 60 number 4, attention was called to the fact that the brighter variables have the longer periods, but at that time it was felt that the number was too small to warrant the drawing of general conclusions. The periods of 8 additional variables which have been determined since that time, however, conform to the same law." Henrietta Swan Leavitt had determined that the length of a Cepheid variable star's pulsation was directly correlated with its brightness. This means that you can tell how far away a faintly pulsing star is based on how long the pulse lasts. This correlation became known as Leavitt's Law, and it allowed astronomers to accurately determine how far away distant stars actually are for the first time. In 1920, astronomers held a great debate at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History over the nature of the universe. One side argued that the Sun was the center of the universe, and all the distant galaxies and nebulae that astronomers observed were structures in the outer part of our own solar system. The other side argued that these structures were actually different independent galaxies, similar to our own, and that the universe was much larger than anyone had previously imagined. Leavitt's law allowed astronomers to calculate the true distance to some of these distant galaxies, so the entire scientific model of the universe was revised. Just a few years later, an astronomer named Edwin Hubble used Leavitt's law to measure the distance between galaxies and determine that the universe was expanding. Hubble recognized the magnitude of Henrietta Swan Leavitt's contributions to astronomy, often commenting that she should have received a Nobel Prize. In fact, she came close to doing so. According to Air and Space magazine, Leavitt's discovery was so important that in 1924, Gösta Mittag-Leffler of the Swedish Academy of Sciences tried to nominate her for the Nobel Prize. Unfortunately, Henrietta died of cancer 3 years before this, and the Nobel Prize is not awarded posthumously.
A young woman with one of the greatest names we've ever read joined the Harvard Observatory team in 1896. Unlike the previous generation of Harvard computers, When Annie Jump Cannon arrived at the observatory, she was already an expert in astronomy and photography. After Annie lost her hearing at a young age, perhaps from scarlet fever, she spent many nights in a home observatory with her mother. From the attic windows of their home near Dover, Delaware, the two would stay up late at night watching the stars using an old astronomy textbook to identify what they observed. Annie Jump Cannon at first attended Wesley College in Delaware, but was soon encouraged to transfer to Wellesley so that she could have access to a more challenging curriculum. She studied physics under Sarah Frances Whiting, one of the only women physicists in the nation at that time. Her interest in astronomy deepened, and she excelled in her studies. In 1884, Annie graduated as valedictorian of her class with a bachelor's degree in physics. Because she was young and unmarried, and our society could hardly imagine any other path with her, she then moved back to Delaware. At some point, Cannon developed an interest in photography. She toured Europe in 1892, and the photos she took with her Blair camera were later published in a book titled In the Footsteps of Columbus. The Blair Company distributed the book at the 1893 World's Fair to promote the quality images that their cameras could produce, so it seems that Annie was a pretty decent photographer. After her mother died in 1894, Annie began looking beyond her childhood home again. She contacted Professor Whiting at Wellesley, and Professor Whiting hired her as a junior physics instructor. Cannon took graduate-level physics classes, and began studying spectroscopic photography. She soon began taking astronomy courses at Radcliffe, which got her access to the Harvard Observatory. In 1896, Edward Pickering hired her to work on the team that was classifying and cataloging the stars.
She was frighteningly good at it. In her career, Annie Jump Cannon cataloged over 350,000 stars, and people said that she remembered all of them. When somebody would ask about a star she had worked on, she immediately knew the star's type, the reference number for the photographic plate it was on, and which quadrant of the photo it was in. Very quickly after joining the observatory team, she realized that the classification system developed by Wilhelmina Fleming and a woman named Antonia Maury was woefully inadequate. Based on the ions present in a star's spectrum, she would classify them as an O, B, A, F, G, K, or M-type star. Although it has been extended to include some star types that hadn't yet been discovered then, the classification system developed by Annie Jump Cannon in the 1890s is still the standard by which astronomers around the world categorize stars. Astronomy students learn its classes with the mnemonic device, O be a fine girl, kiss me. Cannon's career was right at the cusp between two eras. Women who followed her would be recognized as true astronomers, while the women who came before her were dismissed as menial computers. As Air and Space magazine put it, though Cannon and Leavitt's work was fundamental to astronomical research in the early 20th century, they were still limited by their role as computers. Computers reduced data, but did not create the data, nor interpret their results. Wilhelmina Fleming had been named as curator of astronomical photographs at Harvard, but before her death in 1911, she received few other honors or awards to recognize her groundbreaking work. Henrietta Swan Leavitt was considered for a Nobel Prize, and was a member of both the American Astronomical and Astrophysical Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, but received no awards during life for her discovery that literally changed mankind's understanding of the universe. Edward Pickering, on the other hand, got plenty of awards before his death in 1919. He was made a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, he was awarded the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society, and the Valls Prize of the French Academy of Sciences, the Henry Draper Medal from the National Academy of Sciences, a Prix Jules Janssen, the highest award of the Société Astronomique de France, and the Bruce Medal for outstanding lifetime contributions to astronomy. Not bad for essentially putting your name on someone else's work.
After Fleming's death, Annie Jump Cannon took over as Harvard's curator of astronomical photographs. To mark this passing of the torch, Cannon wrote an obituary for Wilhelmina Fleming, saying, "Industrious by nature, she was seldom idle, and long years of observatory work never unfitted her for the domestic side of life. As much at home with the needle as with the magnifying eyepiece, she could make a dainty bag, exquisitely sewed, or dress a doll in complete Scotch Highland costume. She was never too tired to welcome her friends at her home or at the observatory, with that quality of human sympathy which is sometimes lacking among women engaged in scientific pursuits. Her bright face, her attractive manner, and her cheery greeting with its charming Scotch accent will long be remembered by even the most casual visitors to the Harvard College Observatory. Fleming's obituary from the Royal Astronomical Society followed in the same vein. As an astronomer, Mrs. Fleming was somewhat exceptional in being a woman, and in putting her work alongside that of others, it would be unjust not to remember that she left her heavy daily labors at the observatory to undertake on her return home those household cares of which a man usually expects to be relieved. She was fully equal to the double task, as those who have had the good fortune to be her guests can testify, and it is perhaps worthy of record, as indicating how lightly the double burden sat on her, that she yielded to none in her enjoyment of a football match, especially a match between Harvard and Yale. And they described one of her discoveries as an achievement bordering on the marvelous. Cannon earned a long list of awards in her own right, and completed a master's degree in astronomy from Wellesley, but she was never granted a PhD and the recognition that would come with being a real astronomer. She became the first woman to be awarded the Henry Draper Medal for investigations in astronomical physics, and the first woman elected as an officer of the American Astronomical Society. She received honorary doctorates from Oxford and a Dutch university. She won the Ellen Richards Prize from the Association to Aid Scientific Research by Women, and in 1929 was named one of the greatest living American women by the League of Women Voters. In 1934, she established the Annie Jump Cannon Award, which recognizes American women who make distinguished contributions to astronomy, and the first would go to her protege.
In the meantime, a California pioneer became one of the first American women to earn a doctorate in astronomy and the gravitas that comes with it. Phoebe Waterman did her PhD work at Berkeley and wrote a dissertation testing whether Annie Jump Cannon's classification system for stars would hold true for a newly discovered type of hot stars. It did, and she was awarded her doctorate in 1913. Back at Harvard, a young Englishwoman named Cecilia Payne enrolled at a graduate astronomy program at Radcliffe and began working under Annie Cannon at the observatory. Her 1925 doctoral dissertation further refined Cannon's classification system, and she made the breakthrough discovery that stars are mostly made up of hydrogen and helium, rather than iron, oxygen, and silicon like the Earth. Astronomer Otto Struve would later describe her work as the most brilliant PhD thesis ever written in astronomy. Air and Space magazine describes what happened when Payne shared her work with the world, and specifically, with a man who was considered a leader in the field. Payne sent her thesis to Henry Norris Russell of Princeton, a leading expert on stars, who rejected her conclusions. Admitting to an abundance of hydrogen would have required a full rethinking of the theory of how stars work, a conclusion much too radical for a PhD student to make. Payne changed her conclusion to highlight the similarities between the ratios of the elements in the spectra and in the Earth's crust, rather than focus on the abundance of hydrogen and helium. During the next 4 years, however, evidence in favor of Payne's findings began piling up. Finally, in 1929, Russell admitted that her findings were correct, writing his own paper that convinced astronomers everywhere of this monumental change. Again, a man basically put his name on a brilliant female astronomer's work.
Cecilia Payne, later Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, spent her entire career at Harvard Observatory. She worked closely with Annie Jump Cannon until Cannon passed away in 1941, receiving the inaugural Annie J. Cannon Award in 1934. At the time, her only title was Assistant to the Observatory Director. In 1945, she was given the official title of Astronomer. Then, in 1956, she became the first woman to be promoted to a full professorship at Harvard School of Arts and Sciences. Later, she would be the first woman to chair a department at Harvard. So we can draw a straight line from the Scotch maid Wilhelmina Fleming to Professor Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin. Fleming and Henrietta Swan Leavitt made significant contributions to astronomy, but had no title or recognition. Annie Jump Cannon got the recognition, but never the title or degree. And finally, Cecilia Payne would throw the door wide open, educating and inspiring the next generation of astronomers of both sexes. Although Annie Jump Cannon and later generations of women were able to publish their work and get credit for their discoveries, Wilhelmina Fleming and the early pioneers in the field were mostly forgotten by history for a long time. Fleming's discoveries were published in scientific journals and articles attributed to Edward Charles Pickering. Sometimes those articles would mention Wilhelmina's contributions, but often they would not. A team of archivists at Harvard is trying to change all that. While digitally scanning glass plate photographs taken at the Harvard Observatory between the 1880s and the 1920s, Lindsay Smith Zoll found some long-forgotten boxes. Inside were hundreds of notebooks kept by the human computers of Harvard during the early days of spectrographic astronomy. They contained calculations, data tables, and notes about star classifications and new discoveries.
So far, the team has been able to cross-reference the initials on the glass plates and notebooks and identify the names of 130 women who worked at the observatory. Many were computers, some were assistants, and a handful were the wives of male astronomers who went to work at the observatory to help with their husbands' research. For decades, the legacy of this work has been forgotten in dusty boxes in a Harvard basement, but today you can help reestablish the legacy of these extraordinary women. As awareness of these priceless primary source documents spread, the efforts to preserve and digitize them became a joint effort between the Harvard Library, the Smithsonian, and NASA, known as Project Phaedra. Project Phaedra is appropriately named for a Greek goddess, and it happens to also stand for preserving Harvard's early data in research and astronomy. Now that the Harvard Library has scanned the notebooks Smith-Zoll's team found, the Smithsonian has put them online as a crowdsourced transcription project. Volunteers like you can go to the project site, spend a few minutes learning how to transcribe data tables, star charts, and sketches, then start transcribing pages. Another volunteer will check your work, then experts from the Smithsonian will validate it. The project is expected to take years to complete. When it's finished, the scientific data collected by the women of the Harvard Observatory will be searchable in the Harvard Catalog, the NASA Astrophysics Data System, and the Smithsonian Transcription Center. Harvard head librarian Dinah Buquin says, "You'll be able to do a full-text search of this research. If you search for Wilhelmina Fleming, you're not going to just find a mention of her in a publication where she wasn't the author of her work. You're going to find her work."
I think it's only fitting to give Annie Jump Cannon the last word in this week's episode. She gave one of her last interviews with World War II already raging in Europe and the U.S. on the brink of entering. Her advice seems equally valid today. In these days of great trouble and unrest, it is good to have something outside our own planet, something fine and distant and comforting to troubled minds. Let people look to the stars for comfort.
To learn more about Harvard's human computers, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/058. We'll have pictures of Wilhelmina Fleming, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and Annie Jump Cannon at work in the observatory among a group of their fellow computers, as well as digitized journals that Fleming kept during the year 1900 describing her work. We'll have a link to the Smithsonian Transcription Project where you can see the works that have been completed and volunteer to help with this historic work. And we'll have links to several articles where you can learn more about these pioneers. Plus, a special hat tip this week to the blog Self-Rescuing Princess Society for first tipping me off about Wilhelmina Fleming. And, of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time to talk about the rise and fall of Puritan Massachusetts.